This is good sound waves.
Whatever sounds good.
Thank you for joining us today for what will be the fifth episode of the Good Sound Waves podcast. For our guest host, we have Coach Cletus, and I'm the other guy. Our guest for today's episode is Texas native, but now Northeast Ohio's singer-songwriter, J.J. Vickers.
Well, I'd like to say welcome to the show, J.J., Reverend.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know you personally, but I'm glad you're here because when I first was exposed to you about 4 or 5 years ago, I used to go to Canton a lot. And there's that bar, George's. You're familiar with it.
Oh, yeah. I used to be part of the furniture there.
Exactly, and I know that now, and I'm hoping to get to know you better after today. But I just walked in there to get some food and spirits, and you were performing on that basically coffee table of a stage.
Yeah.
And
if that stage was any smaller, it'd be adultery.
Right, we'd all be on top of each other, man. But George is known for always getting great, unique acts that you may not hear otherwise, and you're no different. When I heard your particular style, it was unique. It turned my ear, and I felt like, wow, this guy's got that greasy, gravelly, hopping sound. So, and I really enjoyed that, and
Thank you. That's my
first exposure to your music.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about your style of music, this greasy, gravelly sound? I kind of say rockabilly to a certain degree.
A lot of people around here do, but that's a misnomer that has plagued me. I grew up in Houston, and basically all I'm really playing is Texas blues and early rock and roll. But the real stuff down there, I've noticed that a lot of folks aren't real familiar with. You tell them Texas blues, and a lot of times their only reference point is Stevie Ray Vaughan. But, you know, for those of us who spent quality time there, you know, growing up or whatever, you know, as a guitarist, Texas blues is Blind Lemon Jefferson, Lightnin' Hopkins, T-Bone Walker, Freddie King, Johnny Guitar Watson, Johnny Copeland, Mance Lipscomb, and people like that.
And I am embarrassed to say that I only recognize about 4 of those names.
Well, most people who aren't hardcore blues fanatics usually don't recognize more than 1 or 2 of those names. So don't feel bad.
You say you're from Texas.
Yeah, I grew up in Houston.
And
West Side.
What was your exposure, your first exposure to music that got you to want to play? Like, what made you want to play, and how did you get started?
Oh, that goes way, way back. My parents were musicians, and they both grew up in the 50s, and they were listening to rhythm and blues before the white kids got into it and turned it into rock and roll. So they were not Elvis fans. They were into, you know, Ray Charles and B.B. King and Louis Jordan, people like that. And when I was growing up, they would have the oldies station on in the car, and right away, that kind of helped form my taste, because I'd hear like Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis and say, hey, yeah, this is cool, I like this. But then, you know, the next song would be something like Patti Page, How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? And I'm like, oh God, I hate this, you know? So that kind of set the tone early on, you know? It's like, okay, yeah, I'm on this side, I'm not on that side. You know, you
like the grit, you don't like the bubble gum.
Exactly, I like the grit and not the bubble gum. Later on, as you know, I got hip to Who's Who and the history of it all. I found out that basically my taste ran along the same lines as Sam Phillips, his own studio. You know, I just like him. You know, I just like the raw stuff. I'm not as concerned, you know, with flashy stuff or technical precision. But for me, it's about just that raw gut feeling. You know, that's why I like the old blues stuff, is because it's just so raw and they're so direct. There is no recorded music that I've ever heard, and my record collection goes back, I'm talking like record collection, things I went out and cultivated before you could just access it all online. My record collection goes back to the beginning of recorded music, and I have never heard anything that just across the decades can still hit so hard, like it was recorded this morning. Nothing like the old blues guys hits that hard.
When did you actually pick up a guitar? And was it acoustic guitar at first, or was it electric?
Well, I started out on drums. I did marching band and all that. And I played in jazz band. There was a thing in Houston there called Summer Jazz Workshop. I went there for a couple of years. But I had two problems with it. One was that with the jazz guys, they wanted you moving around on the kit all the time. And even at 11 years old, I had already been weaned on early rock and roll, which is all about that pounding backbeat. So that just, I wasn't hearing it. And there was nothing wrong with my playing. They just didn't like the fact that it was so simple. But for me, that's what it was about, that simple backbeat. So that kind of killed my interest. The other thing that killed my interest was that you didn't meet a lot of girls behind the drum kit. So I thought I should be a singer and stand out.
That front man.
Exactly. Then I found out I couldn't sing. So I thought, I better learn, you know, I was like 13, right? Yeah, I thought, well, I better learn to play an instrument first. And initially, I started with bass because my mom played bass. And then I kind of didn't know what to do with it, so I went over to a guitar because my dad was a guitarist and he had a couple lying around. So, and to your answer of acoustic or electric, being that my dad was a jazz guitarist, we didn't have as much distinction between the two. Electric was just an amplified acoustic. So my the earliest ones I was banging around on, they were, you know, hollow bodies and thin hollow bodies, just unplugged, you know, just didn't bother to plug them in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could hear yourself sing in your bedroom,
definitely.
So there was no need.
My next question is, and you answered that one thoroughly, is did you prefer starting off with flat picking or with just fingers?
Well, I started out with a flat pick because that was what my dad showed me. But after a few years, when I started to become more aware of other styles, you know, and you know, you're talking about being in your early teens, so, you know, 2 or 3 years roll by, that's kind of a long stretch at that age. There's a lot of things to discover in that time frame.
Oh, yeah.
And I found out that a lot of the old blues guys, you know, like Lightning and Muddy Waters and so forth, they all played with thumb picks. And so after the first few years, I tried to play with a thumb pick, but I just couldn't do it. Johnny Winter also played with a thumb pick. I just couldn't do it until a couple years ago when I started doing it on solo gigs, because the flat pick, I noticed, like on the shuffles, on blue shuffles, the flat pick kind of lent itself to rushing it, and I wanted that really laid back swamp sound.
Oh yeah.
So if I did it with a thumb pick, then I could play behind the beat easier instead of rushing it. But I did get into a lot of finger style stuff. Also, a lot of the blues guys from around Houston who had came up after T-Bone Walker, guys like Albert Collins and Johnny Guitar Watson and Gatemouth Brown, they all played with their fingers. They just yanked those strings. They put a capo halfway up the neck and just...
There you go.
Yanked the strings as hard as they could. Yeah.
Now, and I appreciate that too, because I actually started with fingers too, but... And then I'm just playing with pick. But you kind of remind me, and I don't mean this in any bad way, just a compliment, kind of you got that George Thorogood feel to me somewhere in there. Do you follow George Thorogood at all? Or
Actually, yeah, I have a buddy who plays with Thorogood, Jim Suler. He's out of Dallas. We get together whenever they roll through the area and just kind of just hang out and talk guitars and stuff. But going back to your Thorogood reference, I'm a real big fan of his early stuff on Rounder Records. When he first came out, he was playing that thin hollow body as a Gibson 125 with the P90s in it, running that through a Fender amp. And I just, you know, and of course I love
preach,
that
Preach, Reverend, preach.
Right. And he was playing a lot of the same kind of stuff that I was already listening to, you know, like Muddy Waters and Hound Dog Taylor and Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry. So, you know, so it was kind of like, oh, I guess, you know, if he can do, you know, if he can play the blues stuff like that, you know, I guess this little Jewish kid can do it too, you know.
Right on. And I wasn't trying to compare you to him, but I just felt like in my heart that he was an influence because of, you know, similarities.
He was more of an inspiration than an influence.
There you go.
Some guys were influences, some guys were inspirations. Guys like Lightnin' Hopkins, T-Bone Walker, Freddie King. Those guys were the textbook vocabulary. Those are the guys that when somebody comes up to me and says, I want to learn to play guitar, where do I start? You know, go buy a Jimmy Reed album. You know, those guys were the basic vocabulary. But guys like George Thorogood, Johnny Winter, Rory Gallagher, those guys were kind of the inspiration. You know, they're the ones that, you know, it's like, oh, if they're already out there doing it and being successful at it, then, you know, maybe I'm not that weird after all. Because, you know, in high school in the 80s, I was the only kid that was listening to this stuff. Everybody right. else was either into metal or new wave. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was listening to the, you know, to these old blues guys, these albums that were already, you know, 30 years old. And they thought I was from outer space.
Oh, I can relate to that. I don't know why, but... But, yeah, it's being confident in what you do. It's you don't have to be like anybody or anything. It's just being confident and having fun what you're doing, and I can tell that's what you do.
Well, I've been doing it for a while. Also, I don't know how to do anything else.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your current projects. What we're working on now. I know you are working with us here at Good Sound Waves a little bit on some recordings. Can you talk to us a little bit about what your goal is, what you're trying to achieve with what you're doing?
Okay, well, what we're doing right now is finishing up my seventh full-length release. It's all instrumental. It's called Pickin' and Grinnin', which is also the name of the title track. The reason it's all instrumental is because all these songs kind of fit together. Usually when I'm, well, not usually, but always when I make an album, I don't just throw the songs together randomly. For me, the songs on an album are like chapters in a book. They have to go together. And this one, it just kind of went out that way. But I've always done instrumentals. Most of my albums have instrumentals on them. Some of the first songs that I learned on guitar starting out were instrumentals. Bill Doggett, Honky Tonk, Lonnie Mack, Memphis. Jimmy Smith, Back at the Chicken Shack, and a tune called Coming Home, which we recorded on this album.
Speaking of your current projects and stuff, I'm not up to date on everything, but I did request when I walked in the studio today that I could maybe hear just a snippet of anything, and I did get to hear, what was it, Last Train Coming?
Last Train Home.
Last Train Home, and that was really good. It really got my attention, and I sat down. I didn't try to walk around and just do whatever. I really sat down and listened to it, and immediately I asked studio producer here, the other guy, you know, is this all instrumental? Because that's how I felt it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yeah, it's going to be instrumental. And you just kind of cleared that all up. You know, the story, they all kind of come together. It's a meaning.
Well, that song has a story of its own, too. Quite most of them do. That one, it's the closing theme that the band always plays at the end of the night. So, you know, folks in this area, when they hear it, they'll recognize it. Only difference being is on the gig, we usually tag it with Rumble, the Link Ray tune. Obviously, we didn't do that on the album. And it was literally written on the Last Train Home. When I was overseas, I had this little travel guitar, a headless guitar I used to take around with me. It was, you throw it in a gig bag, and it was about the size of a tennis racket. And I was, and over there, you know, I was using public transportation all the time. I didn't drive. And so sometimes you would take a late night train, and there'd be almost nobody on there. So one night I was coming home from a gig, and I was on that train by myself, or with maybe one other person, you know, 50 feet away, something like that. And I pulled it out, and I started noodling around. I was trying to remember the Mystery Train riff, the Scotty Moore's Mystery Train riff. And it just kind of came out like that. And I went, oh, that's pretty cool. And then we started jamming on it on the gigs, used it as a little bit of a filler piece because I didn't know what to do with it. But as time went on, playing it on the bandstand over the years, you know, certain licks would stand out. So most instrumentals, I do them like jazz players do, because I grew up around jazz players. And also the form makes sense. You know, you play the head twice, you take your solos, you play the head twice more, and then you're out. You know, kind of a ABA song structure. So anyways, so playing it on the gigs, initially it was just the head, right? So I'd play the head twice, and then I'd solo through it, play the head twice more, and then the song was over and the gig was over. And but over the years, certain licks stuck, like, oh yeah, that fits in there pretty good, you know, and you would kind of keep coming back to that, you know. So it evolved from an improvised solo into a structured solo. And then once I had the structured solo in place, and that's the way we've been playing it on the bandstand for a number of years now, then it was ready to record.
If I may, so this track that caught my ear this morning,
mm-hmm.
Last Train Home, it's been a long time coming. It's been a a song that's been developing. Now it's finally recorded. And
they all are.
Okay, and that's good. That's fine. I mean,
finally.
That's some of the best songs take years and years to finally develop, and I respect that. And some of them are really long. They could be 5, 6, 7 minutes long, too, because they did take so long. You got a lot to say, and you bring your songs together as a story and meaning. So I appreciate that story. You said overseas. I know nothing about that. So if you could just touch a little bit on it. You don't have to get deep into it, but it's this trip overseas, and you had gigs. And
On a couple different occasions down through the decades, I lived in Tokyo for a total of 15 years. And last time I was there for close to 10 years, and then now I've been back for close to 10 years.
Oh, wow. Do you speak the language any, or?
Not anymore.
Not anymore?
I don't have nobody to talk to.
Right.
Now, you, like a lot of musicians, are constantly performing. You're gigging all the time. When you perform live, do you perform with a regular lineup, or does your backing band change from regularly? Or is it a lot of solo work, or what kind of, what can people expect?
It kind of spans all three of them. When I first stepped out on my own, decided that I was no longer going to be a sideman and I was going to take control of things, I initially only used pickup musicians for the longest time. And the reason I did that was... years back in the days when we were all chasing record deals and that kind of stuff, you know, you'd put a band together, you'd find the guys, you'd rehearse, then you'd book a few gigs, and then somebody ended up with somebody else's old lady and the band broke up, and, you know, I was like, all right, this is ridiculous, you know. And then later on, I played bass with my dad's group for a while down in Cincinnati, and he, because he had horns, he had charts, and he would book the gigs first, and then he would call the musicians and say, you know, ask, you know, if you're available for a gig, and then if they were, he'd tell them, okay, this is the gig, this is what you're playing, this is what you're wearing, this is how much you're getting paid, you know, and that was that, you know, take it or leave it. And we worked a lot, whereas most of the stuff that I had done before, you know, other than some pickup stuff, we didn't work a whole lot. But at that point, I was a full-time musician. I was making good money. I was like, oh, okay, this business structure works. And also, at the time, what I was doing was a little bit more mainstream than it is now. So musicians in general were more familiar with the style. I mean, these days, you know, young guitarists, they don't even start out on Chuck Berry anymore. You know, that's 101 stuff. I actually heard a guy, I will not name him, but I actually heard a guy playing single note solos on a Chuck Berry song, and that's just un-American. Yeah. Chuck Berry songs, the attention guitar players,
this is
double
a disgrace.
Exactly. Right. All right.
So you were eating. You were making enough money to eat. You were.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was.
That's good.
Yeah, I was living good like that. So I basically adopted that business model, and for the longest time, that was how I did it, and it worked out okay. But over the last, I want to say about the last 5, 6 years, I just became a bit disenchanted with it. Also, nowadays there's not as many people, you know, that have the history with it, that have the vocabulary with it. So where it used to be a very easy just show up and play situation, now it's not. So at that point I thought, you know, I'm putting the same amount into this as I would if I actually had a regular rehearsed group. I think I'm going to give this another shot. Now, even with the pickup guys, I would use the same people on a regular basis. So you see a lot of the, you would see a lot of the same basses and the same drummers. You know, and usually there would be about 2 first call guys, and then I'd have 1 or 2 guys after that. You know, you go down the list, starting with, you know, whoever had worked with me most recently and who was most familiar with the overall style. You know, and now I do have a regular bassist. My old lady's my bassist. That's rather convenient. She's also a very solid bassist, and she's on this recording. She's on about half of it, and then I did a couple songs, and I've got an old friend of mine, a surprise guest, coming in, but we'll talk about that one another time.
Yes. We love surprises.
Yeah. Oh, that one is a surprise. It's going to be a real surprise. As we got a real heavyweight coming in on this one.
This should be fun because, yeah, as most people who've been following along with Good Sound Waves realize, that this is entirely a learning experience from start to finish. No musical background whatsoever, but I found it very easy to be musical around you guys. The people that I've had the blessing, the opportunity to surround myself with in the course of this project. So I'm excited to see who this new person for me is going to be. I'm looking forward to recording brass and wind instruments for the first time ever.
Yeah, we're going to have horns on one of the tunes. We have, you were asking about influences. There's an homage to Ike Turner and his Kings of Rhythm, his early stuff before Tina, when he used to do a bunch of instrumentals. There's two in particular that I like, Twisted the Strings and Prancing. And so I came up with this one tune, and it was kind of a tip of the hat to his early instrumental stuff. And we're putting piano on it today when we get done with this. And then we're going to have a horn section on there. We're going to have tenor and baritone. It's going to be real greasy R&B. Real greasy, old
preach,
school
preach,
R&B.
Really. Man, this is exciting.
Oh, lowriders are going to love this one. This one's going to be a hit with the lowriders. I guarantee it.
Yeah, baby, this is going to be rat and roll.
It's called Twisting and Turning.
All right.
Now, has your music changed much since Sci-Fi Diner, when you first released that one?
Oh, Sci-Fi Diner.
It's been, what, 21 years since that came out, I think?
Yeah, it's been a lifetime, or two. two, to be exact. And, I wouldn't... Changed? No. I would say that it's deepened a bit in the sense that... 20 years of playing and recording and just doing it, you learn something along the way. If you're paying attention, you learn something along the way. Sci-Fi Diner, that was originally demos because I just needed some kind of recording. I had just gone out on my own. I didn't have any recording. I was living in Austin at the time, and Mike Buck of the original Fabulous Thunderbirds and of the Roy Brothers, I wanted him on drums more than anything, and J.J. Barrera from the Tailgaters on bass. And I thought, anybody I get, I'm going to want them to play like these guys. I know these guys, and I live in the same town as them. I ought to just get them, so called them up, and we wheeled and dealed and all that, and we set the session. And that one was fun because it was the three of us live. Most songs on there were third take, and that's, having not rehearsed them prior to going into the studio.
The first two takes were your rehearsal.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah. There was one on there that took about five takes, and the final take on it is still a little stiff compared to the other performances on the album, but... and then the acoustic songs were added later. But when we went to mix it, I had no idea how to mix it. And I just kept recording and working with different people and reading books. Ken Collate, who engineered and produced Rumors, Fleetwood Mac, one of the biggest selling albums of all time, he wrote a book on the making of that album that, it has all the soap opera stuff that I largely skipped over, but he goes into a lot of technical detail about how they recorded stuff, how they got particular sounds and sound effects and all that. And I mean, he just really lays it out. So that book, when I had to, I was finishing up three albums at once, all on my own, with no clue as to how to do any of it. And that book became a little bit of a Bible for me. I'm very thankful to him for writing that. I'd still like to buy him a beer for that one.
So that's your Bible, and you are self-ordained reverend.
No, I'm ordained through the Church of the Latter-day Dude.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that from Texas?
No, that's from the Big Lebowski.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, somebody actually started a religion around it, and I was like, ooh, a religion based on laziness. I like this. Yes, I do weddings. I've done a few of them, including Billy King's wedding. And I offer a two-in-one package as well. I can do the service, the band can play the reception, and we can do both.
And
contact
we can drink.
Us for a race. Oh, yeah.
I understand your other half, not that kind of doctor, Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
She plays bass for you. She's basically been installed as your bass player, stopping the revolving door there.
Yes.
On drums. What's the gentleman's name that I met that was playing?
David Schaefer.
David Schaefer.
He's from New Mexico. He moved up to Cleveland about, I think maybe a year ago, something like that. And I came across him through a mutual acquaintance, and he's from the same part of the country as I am, so there's a shared language there. there. So we work together very well, and I use them as much as possible, including on this album.
Well, I wanted to kind of touch on, I didn't know this, but you originally hail from Texas, but now you're here in the heartland. And this is a great country. I myself have been all over the country, and I'm not originally from here, but I always seem to come back here into the heartland because the people, the music scene is so huge here and appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Even when times are down and things look pretty bleak, everybody still enjoys and supports their local musicians at any level. So how long have you been in the heartland and performing?
Well, this time around, I've been here for about 9.5 years now. I had been up here before. One side of my family's from this part.
Okay.
Actually, from Alliance, to be specific.
Okay,
so,
not too far from here.
Yeah, so, well, that's my connection to the area.
All right.
I'd like to know a little bit more about the Desiatos. Did I say that right?
Close enough, yeah.
Desiatos?
The Desiatos, yeah.
Okay, yours sounds better. It's probably because it's
that's just kind of how I pronounce it. I got it out of a book, so okay. I don't really know how it's pronounced. I'm not going to say what book. It's a literary reference. I kind of leave it out there for anyone who's interested to guess, and occasionally on gigs, I'll just announce over the microphone, first person to catch the reference, I'll buy him a drink, and every now and then somebody does.
Now, how long have they been together, the Desiatos? It looked like...
Well, I've been using that band name ever since I needed to tack a band name at the end of my name.
Okay, so that was a name you've used for your backing band.
Yeah.
So whoever happened to be in it, that was an ongoing name.
Whoever's on the gig that night, they're a Desiato.
Fair enough. All right, JJ, your newest album, what you're working on right now, is the album called Pickin' and Grinnin', which is one of the track titles on there. Can you tell us a little bit about where that name came from or the story behind the song?
Well, the title itself is kind of an old line, you know, it's like, hey, what you doing? Pickin' and Grinnin'. But the recording itself, it's a guitar duet with my guitar mentor, I like to call him. Don Leedy, most known for his work with the Tailgaters. I'd been listening to the Tailgaters ever since I started playing guitar. In fact, their first album, Swamp Rock, was one of the albums that I learned to play guitar off of, because when I was starting out, that's how you learn to play. You figured out stuff from records by ear, which was excellent ear training. Long and painstaking, but excellent ear training. Anyways, So Swamp Rock was one of the albums I learned to play off of, and I still do the song Rock and Roll Till the Cows Come Home on gigs. I just love the song. It's a fun tune. And when I lived in Austin, I looked up Don, and I got to know him. I had met him once before when the Tailgaters played in Australia. I didn't know they were down there. I was down there, and they happened to be down there. I was like, oh, well, I got to go see them. Took 6 buses to get to the other side of town, but I made it. You know? This was like the day after I landed in Sydney, so it's not like I know my way around town either. But anyways, so I got to know Don when I was in Austin and stayed in touch over the years. And one time I was back visiting, and I was hitting him up for a guitar lesson, and he invited me over. He was fooling around with his 4-track at home studio, and he invited me over to work on something with him. He had this little guitar boogie thing he was working on. He wanted another guitar on it. So he's got the little 4-track machine, and he's got a little drum machine there, and he's laying down his part, and then he's telling me, okay, do something like this here, now do something like this here, and then he shows me the ending he wants me to play. And I was like, oh, all right, oh, that's pretty cool, you know, and I couldn't believe, wow, I'm sitting here recording, you know, with my guitar guru. That's actually my nickname for him, my guitar guru. And I, like, every time I run into him, he's got some new thing that he's come up with. Hey, check this out. Look, you know, he'll show me like a half a dozen things, and I remember maybe 2 of them. Yeah, and that's just on guitar. He plays other instruments equally well. And so he overdubs the bass part on it, and as he's laying down the bass part, he turns around and he tells me, and he's got this big grin on his face like a little kid, and he tells me, hey, kind of sounds like Keith. Yeah, meeting Keith Ferguson, original bassist from the Tailgaters and from the original Fabulous Thunderbirds. I'm kind of like, yeah, it does kind of have that Keith Ferguson vibe to it. Anyway, so we finish the tune. He burns me off a disc, and I'm just, you know, blasting it 20 times in a row in the car and everything. It's like, well, I recorded with Don Leedy, you know. It's a cute little thing. And then about a couple months later, I started working on what was eventually my fifth album, Long Way From Home. And while we were working on it, I told him, hey, why don't you send me those dry guitar tracks or isolated guitar tracks, and I'll put a rhythm section on them while we're here. So he sent them to me. And we put the rhythm section on, came out real nice. And then things stalled at that particular studio. That album went on hold for about 3 years before recording was resumed again. And in the meantime, I'd already decided I was going to put this song on this album as the title cut. But every time I went to record the album, because I had started doing demos and so forth, and, you know, doing a little bit of recording here and there, and, you know, trying out different studios and so forth. And so I had put a rhythm section on it again and a number of times, but I didn't have the large files from the original one, so I couldn't use that one. So I had to keep redoing it. And we did it just again this time, and did, I think the best job of it so far. We also beefed up the guitar tracks because they were dry tracks, and, you know, ran them through amps and so forth. So now, you know, it has a real nice live sound to it. And so that's the song that opens up the album. So, you know, if you're listening to the album as an album, you know, that thing kicks in first. You know, you got the nice guitar boogie duet. And then at the end, after Last Train Home is technically the closing song on the album.
Like, technically my favorite so far.
Right on. Thank you. It's technically the closing song because it's also the closing theme on the gigs. But we're going to tag it with an extra track on there. That I've titled Pickin' and Grinnin' Slight Return. And it's the original recording of Don and I with him on bass and the drum machine. I thought that would make a nice little... I thought it would make a nice tag after that final...
Right, it's not quite as much a reprise as I had originally thought. It's actually another flavor type of thing.
Yeah, when you hear the two of them, even though the guitars are the same recording, it's a very different mood when you have just that drum machine in the background and that bass and his bass, you know, with that Keith Ferguson sound. And it has a more subdued kind of vibe to it. But when you hear it with the rhythm section and the guitars went through amps and everything, it sounds a lot more bright and lively. So they're very different moods.
If I may, let's talk gear a little bit.
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay.
And you got a few hours?
No, actually I don't. I just want to make this brief. We don't have much time, but I do want to talk about gear a little bit because that's one thing we haven't talked a lot about on this particular interview. In particular, this latest instrumental album. Talking gear, did you use multiple guitars or did you stick with one and be fluent through the whole recording of this album, or did you use different guitars? And I'd like to hear about that. I'm sure our listeners would too.
Well, initially I had wanted to mainly stick with one guitar, with the exception of, you know, one or two songs that needed a little something different, and that guitar being my main Telecaster that you see on gigs.
So yes.
I assembled that one myself.
Oh, that's your Frankenstein.
That's my Frankenstein.
It's my monster.
Actually, that was the first one I assembled. I've done a couple more since then. But that was the first one. I assembled that for the Canton Blues Fest last year. And
nice.
That was her maiden voyage. And she's been my number one ever since, as she was intended to be. So initially, I wanted to use one guitar on the bulk of it, but
okay.
After we cut the songs, you know, when you're looking at stuff under the microscope like that, I just felt that it needed more texture. So, for example, there's one tune on here called Boogie and A. That one it's got about, by the time we're done with it, it'll probably have a total of about 8 guitar tracks on it.
Oh, like an onion, layered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, and that's exactly what it is layered. It's not 8 guitars going all at once. They're coming in and out. There's a couple of parts that we doubled and then panned them. So
mm-hmm.
You have one part, but you're kind of hearing it in a particular type of stereo.
Nice.
Yeah. So those guitars, they, you know, they all weave in and out. But what we did was we tracked live. If I played live with the rhythm section, just, you know, the amps in another room isolated, and the three of us just standing in a circle. So that initial performance is live. And then and go back and just touch things up as needed, as the song demands it. The one song that has the really different gear on it is the Ike Turner homage, Twistin' and Turnin'. That one I used an old Korean-made Squire Strat that I got from John Lindstrom at Canton Music years ago.
Oh, way back.
Yeah,
the Lizard Man.
Right, yeah. That's a funky guitar, too. I got flat wounds on that one, and it is funky. And I ran that through a little mid-60s Harmony amp with a little 8-inch speaker, and something about that guitar and that amp. But even when we were first cutting demos of it, and I played them for Lisa, I tracked it with the Telecaster through the Princeton, which is my main rig, and then and when we were listening back to it, like, yeah, it's all right. And then I went back and I redid the guitar with that setup, and she's like, oh yeah, that's what that song needs. It, yeah. So
that's
you hear it right away. That song really needed that particular setup. And also played the one song we'll be adding a piano on today, Cow Tipping. It was actually named after the dog. Some of the songs have stories. Some of the titles have stories.
Yeah, tipping. Is that from Japan? Tipping?
No, cow tipping. Yeah.
Well, cow tipping?
Yeah, no, my ex-wife
Pretty
had a
sure
golden...
Pretty sure from Texas.
No. Well, almost. My ex-wife had a golden retriever, and Japanese houses are really, really tiny. So when the dog would lay on her side in the middle of the floor in this, you know, tiny house, I used to crack the, hey, she looked like a tipped cow. You
right.
know? They didn't know what cow tipping was, so I had to explain it to them. She
right.
translated and all that. But I don't know, the tempo of the song kind of reminded me of the dog a little bit, so
you
that's
mentioned
what I named it.
Your amp. Now, is that a Blonde? Is that an older one? Or
No. That's the Sweetwater Special. Basically, it's the 65 circuit, so it's pretty clean sounding, although I do drive it a bit. But rather than the 10-inch speaker, it has a 12-inch Cannabis Rec speaker. It's a hemp cone speaker.
Oh, nice.
And, a guy I used to know turned me on to those, and I really like the sound of them. That hemp cone, it has really nice, warm presence to it.
Wow, I'm not hip to that. I'm going to have to look into that. That's
check
nice.
Them out. You love them. And we're using a few other ones. I have a clone of an early Tweed Princeton. It's got a 12-inch Jensen in it. That's on a number of things. And also an old Dan Electro amp from the 50s that belongs to my dad.
So you warm up those hemp speakers, and they have a nice smell to them, don't they?
I haven't warmed them up that hot yet. And that's even with the volume on 7, yeah.
All right, lucky number 7.
Yeah. Oh, and there's also the blue telly on there, too, while we're talking gear.
Oh, so there's multiple guitars you
use. Oh, yeah.
And that's what I was trying to get at.
All kinds of stuff, yeah.
That's nice.
This one, that one Boogie and A that we're layering the guitars on, used the blue telly, the main telly, and an Epiphone Les Paul Jr., or actually, I'm sorry, Les Paul Special. Two pickup model. But this blue telly, it's I got it off of a guy that used to do some of my amp repair. It's one that he assembled himself. He got a bunch of bodies real cheap and had some other parts laying around. And it has a gold foil pickup in the neck position. It gives it a really unique sound. Also, I put Graftech saddles on it at Don Leedy's suggestion. I put Graftech saddles on it, and there's something about those graphite saddles, because they have a real cut in the high end. They really take out a lot of that spike you can sometimes get with a telly. And there's something about the combination of that pickup and that bridge, and it also has a copper pick guard. It's stamped copper. It's really thin because the pickup mounts directly on the pick guard, so you can't adjust the height.
All right.
So we had to get the thinnest material possible in order to lower it, and even then the bridge pickup still isn't quite loud enough in relation. But I don't use the bridge position on that guitar anyhow. I mainly use it for specialty things, and it has a very distinct tone. It's a cross, to my ear, it's a cross between a fat Strat tone and a Charlie Christian pickup.
Hey, well, that's why you customize your guitars. You're looking for these sounds.
I got tinkeritis. Well, you know, talking about, you know, Don Leedy and Stevie Ray Vaughan, those guys, that was another thing that I grew up on, you know, as a teenager when I started playing. You know, all the Austin guys, It's the, you know, Jimmy and Stevie and Don, everybody, you know, they were playing the kind of stuff, they were like younger guys playing the kind of stuff that I had already been listening to. You know, they came out of blues and early rock and roll and all that. And I was listening to them at the same time, especially after I started playing guitar. And that was them and Eric Johnson, all those Austin guys, they were really big on, you know, hot rodding their guitars, you know, rewiring stuff and putting different combinations of amps together, blending the amps to get sounds. Actually, when I did Sci-Fi Diner, I gave Don a copy of it, and he told me, you know, sounds good, but try using two amps next time, because I just used one amp on the whole thing. He says, try using two amps next time and blending the sound. So I was like, ooh, that sounds interesting. And so I tried it. I was like, oh, this is beautiful, you know. So you hear it, the last album, Irreverent Dissident, and about half of that we recorded the same way. The trio sets up, we record live, and then we overdub as, you know, the song right calls for it. And but like most of the stuff on that one, I ran about three amps at once, and then we blended them in the mix. Long way
you amped it up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Long Way From Home from that album, during the intro and the solo, you know, when the guitar is playing the lead lines out front, that's the old Dan Electro amp. It's got this really dirty, gnarly sound. But we had two other Fenders that were, they had a little bit of grit to them, but they were relatively clean. So we had those panned left and right, maybe about 75%, and that Dan Electro right down the middle. And then so for the solos, and for the intro, we would just bring that one in and out, maybe back off the other two a little bit.
Yeah. Half a lap.
Yeah. So you get a lot of, but you do, those guys are right, though. You do get a lot of really interesting sounds.
That's cool.
When you blend the amps together.
That's nice. A lot like how we're layering the different instruments together, the different amps and different guitars together in the music that we're making right now, because mm-hmm. we're not relying on one guitar to be able to give that full range.
Right. Instead, mm-hmm. more bounce to the amps.
Taking the best characteristics of each piece and putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been making a really neat layer. I want to thank you for having us out to tape you over at Tiki Underground the other day.
Oh, thanks for coming out and doing it. That was a lot of fun. It was really, I've been playing at Tiki Underground for a number of years. Sean and Jesse are wonderful people. I love working with them. They're one of my favorite venues to work with. We always have a good crowd in there. The drinks are good too, although I don't get too much of that because I'm working. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. I respect that too. I'm the same way.
You sat there and played for damn near 3 solid hours. You know, you had a chance to take a swig off your beer once or twice.
Well, the thing is I don't smoke cigarettes anymore. So when I go on break, I don't know what to do with my hands, and I wind up just kind of putting them in a guitar position. So I thought, I might as well just keep playing. I don't have anything else to do with my hands. You know?
Exactly, keep playing.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to sit down with us today here at the Good Soundings Podcast. Well,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, you can thank me too.
I'd like to thank Cletus Stimpy for taking the time to join us as a co-host for another episode of the Good Soundways Podcast.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Coach Cletus is always ready to, you know, do what I need to do in the name of good music.
Music for today's episode of the Good Soundways Podcast was provided by our guest, J.J. Vickers. This episode of the Good Soundways Podcast is copyright 2022 by Good Soundways.
This is Good Soundways.
Whatever sounds good.